Hello and welcome to Independent Thinking, the weekly podcast from Chatham House. I'm Bronwyn Maddox, the director. This week, we are focusing on the inescapable question, are Iran and Israel on the brink of war? A greater war, I should say, perhaps because they have been in conflict for a long time, and Iran, of course, backed Hamas, which carried out the October 7th atrocities. Late last Saturday, Iran and its proxies in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon fired 300 cruise and ballistic missiles, along with a whole variety of drones, at various targets in Israel in response to the suspected Israeli strike near the Iranian consulate in Damascus, or at the Iranian consulate in Damascus, as Iran is saying, which killed Senior General Mohammad Reza Zahedi from the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards Corps. Many of you will have seen the pictures of flashes in the night sky above Jerusalem as sirens wailed, and it was the first ever such direct attack on Israel by Iran, and the largest assault by another country on the Jewish state since 1973. In the hours that followed, the barrage was intercepted not just by Israel's formidable defences, but by air forces from the United States and the UK, and significantly Jordan. And France had aircraft as well on patrol. It has been reported that Saudi Arabia and the Emirates contributed intelligence as well.
Israel's war cabinet has been meeting all week to discuss first if Israel would respond, and then it became a question of how and when. We now know some of that answer. We recorded the conversation that's coming up before the news this morning that an Israeli missile has struck Iran, at least one missile. Iranian state media are citing unconfirmed reports of explosions in the central province of Isfahan, but downplaying its impact, saying the city is safe and sound. And a senior Iranian official has told the Reuters news agency Iran has no plan for immediate retaliation against Israel, while in Israel, hardliners have described the strike and the present evidence as disappointing. But that will not stop the region, indeed the world, from deep concern over where this will go next. And all the while, many people continue to be on the edge of starvation in Gaza, and over 100 Israeli hostages remain unaccounted for after being kidnapped by Hamas on 7th October. I was joined by three Chatham House experts from our Middle East and North Africa programme to discuss all this, and here is that conversation.
Returning to the podcast is the director of the MENAP programme, Dr. Sanam Vakil, whose work focuses on Iran, and she's in Iraq at the moment in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, looking at the region. Welcome.
Hi, Bronwyn. Good to see you.
Great to see you. Also returning is our associate fellow, Professor Yossi Meckelberg, who writes and comments on Israel regularly for us and others. Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be again on this podcast.
And finally back again with us as well is Dr. Elham Fakhro, also an associate fellow with the program and an expert in the Gulf Cooperation Council states. And she's in Bahrain, I think. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Great. And I'm in London, but I have just got off the plane from Washington, where indeed this was a hot subject, one of two, the other one being Ukraine, I guess three being the American elections. But those feel eternal at the moment. Sanam, how does this calculation look to you? Iran has said, we regard this as settled, if you like. We've retaliated for the killing of our general. Enough.
I think that you're quite right. Iran, as the attacks were on their way on the evening of the 12th of April, Iran also simultaneously sent out a message that the attacks were over, and in tandem had also telegraphed its intentions, provided warnings through neighboring countries in the region to make clear that Iran's aim was, of course, to retaliate, but to do so in a calibrated way, but one that would actually change the terms of engagement and establish some clearer red lines in the long and shifting adversarial relationship between Israel and Iran. I think what it's important to remember from Iran's perspective since October 7th has seen its personnel and positions across the region and within the axis of resistance, the network of groups in Lebanon, in Syria, and Iraq. They have been consistently attacked by Israel. There have been 18 IRGC commanders who have been killed, alongside, of course, the strike on the Damascus consular facilities. So for Iran, that strike by Israel on April 1st was one step too far. And the calculation was that if they didn't do something to counterstrike and push back and make red lines and deterrence a bit more clear, that Israel would continue to try to degrade Iran's capabilities and regional position.
Let me just ask you one more thing, because this was an extraordinarily coordinated attack. It may not have been very successful, as the US and Israel have spent much time saying, in terms of the targets that it finally hit. But it was coordinated between Iran and some of its supporters in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq. What was it intending by getting all those groups involved?
I think that Iran, also since October 7th, has been showing that the axis of resistance and its role in supporting the axis is no longer just bilateral, if you will. This is a transnational military expeditionary force that has been building for well over a decade. And by coordinating across the region, it is meant to show that there is increased mobilization and increased capabilities that could come over time should threats develop further.
We were flagging up on last week's podcast that Iran has got a foothold in Sudan in that chaotic war there, and that in a way threatens the Red Sea. And we've been flagging that up in Chatham House, too, particularly to companies who say, what should we be worried about that we're not thinking about? That one, among others. Elham, how does the risk of escalation look to you? You look very much at the whole region.
Right. So from the Gulf side, I think they have been very, very careful to avoid escalation, to avoid being drawn into this. In general, I think there's a real stark difference between what you're hearing from Israeli media and the Arab states. So the day after Iran's strike, multiple Israeli media sources did see this and celebrate this as evidence of the formation of a new regional anti-Iran coalition, bringing together the US, Israel, multiple Arab states around a shared objective of repelling Tehran and beefing up defenses against that. Except this is very clearly not what the Arab countries have articulated. Saudi media, for example, has denied that Saudi Arabia has played any role in intercepting Iranian missiles. The UAE has come out with similar messaging. It's only Jordan that has acknowledged its role in intercepting the attack. And I think this is very much in line with the general mood that we've seen of de-escalation, particularly in the Gulf vis-a-vis Iran. So since 2020, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have both looked to calm tensions with Iran. Of course, last year, Saudi Arabia formally restored its relations to Iran. And what we've seen from October 7th onwards until now, not just with the events of last Saturday, is a real test of their commitment to de-escalation. They've refused to participate, I'm talking about Saudi and the UAE, in the US-led Red Sea coalition that has sent a clear message that they don't want to antagonize Iran. Both countries have also advised the U.S. that they don't want any U.S. assets in their territories to be used against Iranian targets. So I think there's a clear mood around the region not to escalate things, to kind of do whatever possible to bring the region back from the brink, and clearly to send a message to Iran that they're not looking to antagonize it. And for its part, Iran has, to some extent, kept its side of the deal. It hasn't hit any U.S. facilities in the Gulf states, for example. And so that's something that's been pretty constant throughout all of these tumultuous events.
I think we should be clear. There are no reports that I'm aware of, credible reports of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates taking part in shooting down these missiles. But there have been reports in the American media that they alerted the US and therefore Israel, perhaps when given some alert by Iran in turn, that in Saudi's case, that its airspace might be affected. Do you find that credible, that they might be, if you like, working with both sides?
Yeah, I think that is credible, and I think it's likely. I think what's important, though, is also to look at their messaging. So while they are working with the US on that, I think they're playing a very, very difficult role to balance between the two sides and not to come off as either, you know, abandoning any role they might have in terms of commitments to the US or wanting to be supportive there. At the same time, not wanting to antagonize Iran either. We're really trying to be very careful about it.
So Yossi, this brings us back to Israel.
The problem is, again, as always in the last 18 months, the Israeli government, as we know it right now, is a far-right government, and the pressure comes from the far-right. And without the far-right, Netanyahu can't survive in power. And if you look at one of them, one of the leading figures in the far right, it's actually suggested that Israel should go berserk. Whatever you can read into this, in going berserk, in other words, attacking Iran directly and with full force. So that's the problem, is the kind of who decides in this government, whether it's the war cabinet, the pressures from those outside the war cabinet, which is also called the cabinet, and these decisions are going to be taken there, and at the same time, how susceptible to pressures from the outside. That makes the situation more volatile and more unpredictable.
Has it taken the pressure off Netanyahu in terms of the world's criticism of Israeli action in Gaza?
I think so, but it's temporary. At the end of the day, it's difficult to change the reality right now in Gaza. More than 33,000 people were killed there. The humanitarian situation is still dying.
That is a reality. It is pretty difficult to change.
And this won't change overnight. It's just changing in a way to see that it helps Israel in the sense when we argue that their countries want to destroy us. Here is Iran attacking us with 300-350 missiles and drones. So there is a reason for us to use force. But it's a very lame justification to what's happening right now in Gaza, while actually we should pay attention also that the situation with the Hezbollah, the clashes with the Hezbollah in Lebanon, is escalating as we speak.
Israel is obviously a country still in trauma from October the 7th and everything that has followed that. But how much are Israelis seeing what is happening in Gaza, which obviously in other countries we see an immense amount of?
I think we need to remember that most Israelis don't see many of what we see. They're watching mainly Israeli channels. They barely either don't have interest because they don't want to know the truth, or they're exposed to the kind of information that the Israeli government, and I think the media, is in cahoot with them of not showing what's happening in Gaza, and whether it's the killing, the devastation, people on the verge already suffering from starvation. That's enables the government and the military to continue the operation. On the other hand, for all means and purposes, the war as such almost ended in Gaza. It's almost the aftermath. If you look at the presence of the IDF in Gaza, it's a much more reduced to compared to what even 2 months ago, let alone 6 months ago. The question that Israel doesn't have an exit policy, doesn't have any strategy for the day after, and generally towards the relations with the Palestinians, and the result of it is probably will fall into what we've seen probably since 1967, that inertia dictates what's happened next without any strategy, for instance, to help with the humanitarian crisis, to send new governing for Gaza, withdrawing all completely from Gaza, allowing displaced people to go back to their homes. So what we'll see instead of a strategy and policies that will lead to this is that reality is going to dictate what happens next.
All right, but in between us and reality is still the fact that Israel does not have its hostages back. It doesn't have the key figures it says it is after. And meanwhile, there is 15 miles of rubble that has been left by its action, which is pretty hard for people to go back to in any sense. We can't go deeply into the Gaza question, but Sanam, I wanted to bring you in here. You spend, as well as a lot of time in the region, quite a bit of time in the US. And I wondered what your take was on American influence on Israel now, whether it has much, and if it does, whether it chooses to use it?
It's a very key question. And I think what's really interesting is since the strike on Damascus, there has been a lot of messaging between Israel and Washington and Iran and Washington. And despite all of these claims and fears that the U.S. is abandoning the region, you hear quite frequently, or pivoting to Asia, Washington still does remain the only relevant actor on the ground. It might not be as indispensable as it was, but it is the only player there. And I do think that this relationship between Washington and Israel very much matters. Not if you look necessarily at the past 6 months. I mean, President Biden has taken a particular approach with Israel. And there certainly over the past number of weeks, emerged some very key challenges and difficulties in the relationship. But for Israel, in this moment where it has been internationally isolated, heavily criticized because of its military activities and disproportionate behavior and lack of strategic campaign in Gaza, I think the relationship with Washington is very important. On the one hand, Iran's strike has sort of rehabilitated dynamics between Biden and Netanyahu. But I think secondly, if we are in an escalation ladder, Washington's role not only in constraining Israel, but protecting Israel is going to be ever more important. Should Israel choose to directly strike Iran, and that, of course, would raise the chances for Iran's response, here Washington will provide the security backing that Israel needs in all war games that are conducted and have been conducted about the event of an eventual regional war between the two countries. It's Washington that always has to come in. Israel can get to Iran and get back and achieve that strike on its own, but it's always the next day that Israel has to prepare for. And that's where the axis of resistance and these forward defense policy with Iran around Israel's borders can pose a longer term challenge for Israel.
So let's with that wider picture and a bit of a reaching towards the next day, as you put it, come back to this question of Saudi Arabia, because in all these reasons for worry and real alarm, we could look at the role of Saudi Arabia as something that offers a bit of a hope of stability. As Elham was describing before, it is trying to keep its relations with Iran. It's also trying to keep its relations with the West. And Elham, I wondered if you could take us a bit more into this, whether, in your view, Saudi Arabia is really trying to play a pivotal role in not just avoiding a worse war, but in bringing all this conflict to some kind of resolution.
Saudi Arabia is one of multiple Arab states that have been involved in discussions around how this conflict might come to an end and what happens on the day after, including Egypt, Qatar, and Jordan. So from the U.S. side, Saudi Arabia is seen as pivotal towards reaching kind of a long-term solution to the conflict. The Biden administration very much hopes that Saudi Arabia would be willing to normalize its relations with Israel in exchange for a two-state solution and kind of a long-term plan to end the conflict. Things are, however, much more complicated than the Biden administration might hope. Saudi Arabia has asked, made many major asks in exchange for normalization. These include nuclear technology, advanced missile defense systems, and concrete U.S. security guarantees in exchange for normalization. It's far from clear that that would make it through Congress.
We should be clear that that's what it's asking for is civil nuclear power technology. It's not asking for nuclear weapons, though people have questioned whether or not that would be a gateway to that capability.
So the challenges also include, on the Israeli side, there's no appetite from Netanyahu or really any other mainstream figure in Israel for a two-state solution, not just right now, but even obviously before October 7th. So resolving this, I think while there are a lot of hopes on Saudi Arabia, it's a much, much bigger, more complicated series of factors that have to begin to be untangled. And while Saudi Arabia is playing a positive role, many Arab states are playing positive roles as brokers and go-betweens. I think the burden is much bigger than that you could place on a single state.
So you've put your finger on something absolutely central to this, which is that many countries are looking for some kind of resolution of this conflict, are saying now, finally, is the time. Even out of all this rubble and death, can we get a two-state solution, a state for the Palestinians alongside the Israeli state? But the parties that seem least convinced by this, in fact, even hostile to it, include Israel, and quite often you hear quite a lot of Palestinians, at which point, very hard for others to advance it. Yossi, how are the words two-state solution going down in Israel at the moment?
I think generally the two-state solution becomes sort of a mantra for most people. They have no idea how we are going to solve this. If we don't know what to do with this, so let's go back to two-state solution, whether it's feasible or not. I still believe it is feasible, but we have to change the modality compared to what we thought about it in 1993 in the Oslo years. But it's the best solution because compared to all the other solutions that are might be attractive but not feasible. They're not going to be a one-state solution, but there is a one-state reality, and how you create a two-state solution, one-state reality is the challenge. But as I have said, first and foremost, you need the Israelis and Palestinians to be not only interested, but invested in this and to recognize this is their best way to move forward. And then you can look into what modality. Is it the kind of the old fashioned of setting a border between the two and removing settlers? Is it a confederation or any other idea of a two-state solution? And also, instead of dealing with the kind of only the practicalities first, where is the border moving? How many refugees would return? Actually, to deal with the values and the principles of what is peace, dealing with the same rights for everyone, with self-determination, and the rest. And lastly, I think one of the failures that we need to learn from Oslo, it was a very elitist agreement. It almost ignored the need for a critical mass to support it, but supported actively, proactively, and being invested in this. And this is one of the way forward as well, to create this critical mass that support, because understand that the alternative is what we see now, whether it's in Gaza, in the border, in Lebanon, but also on a regional level, confrontation with Iran.
And what people mean by a one-state solution is a right give up on two states side by side, and Palestinians live within Israel, demand their own rights, and so on. But again, not clear where that goes. Sanam, what is your feeling first about the possibility, I'm even hesitating over that word, of a two-state solution coming out of all of this?
I think that it is extremely hard to imagine that right now, really, because as Elham and Yossi have also described and fed in, we are still in an active war. What's emerged from these regional tensions and the fear of regional escalation is less discussion about Gaza, less discussion about the ceasefire and the hostage release and addressing the dire humanitarian conditions. And without returning to these pressing issues, it makes the day after, the so-called day after discussions, harder to convene around and harder for those discussions to develop. And above all, this is depriving Palestinians of the agency to engage in those kind of conversations. And I think that's what's urgently needed. There hasn't been time and space provided by their own leadership. And of course, Israel is hugely responsible. And then this war for younger generation Palestinians and but also the leadership today to be taking the lead on what comes next. And I don't think the outside-in approach where the U.S. or the West or the region tries to impose the last best tried option, which was the two-state solution, is necessarily going to work out as all of this continues to drag on. And we do have to think of the other scenario, which is a stalemate, an Israeli occupation, a protracted conflict. There is no guarantee that out of the rubble and ashes of this war, that statehood and sovereignty and security will be achieved for Palestinians as well as for Israelis.
There's no guarantee at all that anything resembling peace is going to come out of this. It is unfortunately absolutely possible that a conflict no one in the beginning expected to go on this long simply keeps on going. What all these countries are trying to do, West and in the region, is to improve on that bleak prospect. Let's turn finally to the question of Iran itself and what it wants, what it's trying to do. We're not so many years past when Western countries did a deal with it over its nuclear power and its nuclear weapons program, which it said it didn't have. But anyway, it's progressed towards that. And it was President Trump who then ended that. But, you know, there have been times when Iran has seemed to want openness to other countries, lifting of sanctions and so on. On the other hand, at the moment, it's causing all kinds of trouble. And Israel's President Herzog has said this week that it's about time the world faces this empire of evil in Tehran. Sanam, you spend a great deal of time on Iran and thinking about it. How would you describe, in your view, what Iranian leaders want at this point?
I think it's a really key question. And what continues to surprise me is that there's still confusion about what Iran wants. So let me just lay it out. One, they're seeking regime security and stability. Two, simultaneously, they're seeking to preserve their axis of resistance across the region and make sure they're not degraded. And let's say three, they would like to see the U.S. withdraw from the Middle East. And these remain consistent objectives that the Islamic Republic has been trying to pursue for a number of years now.
Brilliantly concise, and thanks very much indeed for that. Elham, just then going back to this question of the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which has turned out to be a lot more substantial than many people thought it might be. It looked like possibly just a sort of Lego bricks deal clipped together by China, but seems to have provoked quite a bit of conversation between the two of them. How do you see Iran's place in the region and the relationships?
I think this, if October 7th and the events that followed have showed us anything, it's really that the Gulf states are committed to this process of de-escalation with Iran. They really don't want to get caught up in any kind of broader regional war, and they're doing what they can to avoid that. I would say that of many other Arab countries too. For its part, I think it's worth also mentioning that Iran has also, to some extent, not responded in sort of other ways that it could have done. As I said earlier, it hasn't really tried to escalate by hitting U.S. facilities in the Gulf. It hasn't, even from on the border with Hezbollah, I mean, the retaliations have been contained to some extent. These are sort of actions that are helpful in helping avoid a broader regional confrontation. But obviously, the longer this goes on for, the longer there's no ceasefire or real solution to what's happening in Gaza, the more you really do have a risk of this spilling out into a broader confrontation, regardless of what any party wants.
And Yossi, coming finally back to you, because many of these questions at this exact point come back to Israel. Do you think Israel can live with this? The phrase tough neighborhood is one you hear the whole time in Israel as sometimes justification for one thing or another that Israel is doing. And it is a tough neighborhood, but it's also an extremely complex one. And what we've just heard from Sanam and Elham is a picture of countries wanting to bring the conflict in Gaza to a resolution, but also really not wanting any kind of escalation with Iran itself. So they can live with Iran. Can Israel ever?
It has to learn to live with Iran. Iran is going nowhere. Israel is not going nowhere. So in this sense, they have to learn to live with one another and with their contradictory interests. You know, it worries me when you mention that the Israeli president talked about Iran as evil. That's where usually countries fail to find common ground when they describe each other as evil. And Iran describes Israel in very similar terms as a small Satan. And that's where they need to build an architecture within the Middle East that both of them will learn to live together without threatening. And Iran build this ring of proxies around Israel that creates real fear within Israel, whether it's Hezbollah on its 150,000 rockets and missiles and the presence of Iran in Syria. And Israel, with its continuous campaign between wars of assassination of scientists and generals and constant attacking in Damascus, in a way it was neglected also by the international community. And this needs to be de-escalated. But actually, I just read today in the news that Iran could review its nuclear doctrine. In other words, if they believe it was for peaceful purposes, they actually say we might actually go further and develop a military one. And openly talk about that. And that's my aid with allegedly two nuclear powers in the Middle East. And that's not a sign of a more peaceful region.
No, I will get it. It is not. And nuclear proliferation, both in this region and around North Korea, China, is something that we are very much looking at Chatham House. Now, I can't think of all the years when Iran's press counselors have said, oh, it'd be absolutely forbidden, haram, for us to develop a military capability. But the world changes. We are going to have to leave it there. Many of these questions coming back to Israel, but also to Saudi Arabia. And those are two things that we will look at very closely, as we will the US's position. But with that, we're going to have to stop for now. A huge thank you to my guests who have joined us from all over the region, Sanam Vakil, Yossi Meckelberg, and Elham Fakhro. Do follow them all on X, and the details are going to be in the show notes, and you can find all our podcasts on all major platforms. So please do like, follow, subscribe, leave us a review. And if you want to read more from our wonderful Middle East and North Africa program, you can, along with all our other work and our events, loads of those, you can find them all on chathamhouse.org. With that, goodbye from me, Bronwyn Maddox. Till next week. See you then.